The BioWorld Insider Podcast.
This is the BioWorld Insider Podcast. I'm Lynn Yaffe, BioWorld's publisher. It's tough out there for biopharma companies looking for partners right now. Despite strong deal activity over the last 2 years, the volume and value of partnerships began sliding in the first quarter of 23. Mergers and acquisitions are down too, compared to prior years. But are better times ahead? Today, BioWorld staff writer Lee Landenberger is talking with Karen Carey, our managing editor and senior data analyst. She just wrote about biopharma deals in the first quarter and completed M&As. Welcome, Karen.
Hi, Lynn. Good to be here.
Also with us is Tim Shannon, a general partner at Canaan Partners. Tim started his career as a physician and later became the CEO of publicly traded Curigan, an oncology firm. He's been with Canaan since 2009. The newest fund from Canaan has $850 million in new capital, including an oversubscribed $650 million fund for seed and Series A financings. Tim told us ahead of this episode that he's somewhat cautious, but sees better times ahead for the market. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks, Lynn. Happy to be here.
Over to you, Lee.
Thanks, Lynn. It's great to have everyone here. You all are uniquely knowledgeable about the current market, which has had its troubles. But we have some new numbers in. We have a better idea of where things stand. And Karen, you wrote a big story for BioWorld earlier this week. It was April 18. You wrote about the first quarter's deals and the M&As. So with your reporting, what was the big takeaway?
I guess the big takeaway is that while deals are down from last year, they still have a respectable showing so far in 2023. And while M&As are somewhat depressed, we see signs of recovery with some of the large ones pending. But financings, on the other hand, they're quite a bit down from recent years. So I guess companies are accessing capital through partnerships. And of course, M&A is a good option for pharmas trying to build their pipelines.
So with these numbers in, can you tell me how they compare with the first quarter of last year?
Okay, let's look at financings. When we track financings, we're tracking everything from IPOs and follow-on offerings to private placements and venture capital amounts. From those four types of financings in the first quarter, the biopharma industry raised $15.6 billion, according to our data. Now, there were 276 transactions that we counted. If we look at the value of those financings, the $15.6 billion, we are ahead of last year's first quarter by 14%. Last year, the figure was about $13.7 billion, so almost $2 billion less. And it was the lowest amount raised for a first quarter since 2017. Now, Q1 of 2023 is the second lowest amount raised since 2017. So we're doing better than we were last year, but not as well as some other recent years. I also wanted to say that the lower financings could be happening for a few different reasons. Of course, as you know, there was a frenzy of financings in 2020 and 2021 during the pandemic. BioWorld tracked well over 1,000 therapeutics and vaccines in development for COVID. There was huge government support, excitement over what the industry could achieve. Generalist investors jumped in, and that resulted in 2021, in that first quarter, $38.3 billion was raised, so more than double of what we've seen this year. But in 2022, generalist investors sort of disappeared. There were concerns over inflation, the Ukraine-Russia war, drug pricing pressures, the World Trade Organization's intellectual property waiver, and of course, Inflation Reduction Act. All of this made it harder for companies to access the public markets. There was also the high cost of capital to consider.
In that April 18 story, you wrote that the volume and the value of partnerships began sliding in the first quarter of 2023. Can you give me an idea what the numbers look like and what were the largest deals?
Sure. Well, we track We track deals as licensings, collaborations, and joint ventures, and then we track M&As separately. So four deals, we had 357 of them for the biopharma industry in the first quarter of 2023. And all of those combined, they were worth $48.1 billion. That's a 16% drop over what we saw in the first quarter of 2022. The volume also is down by 24%. But when looking at all first quarters back to 2017, 2022 was the top Q1 for partnerships. 2021 had the highest volume, but 2022 had the highest value, $57.5 billion. So even though we're behind last year, values of partnerships in the first quarter of this year are the second highest in that same time frame. We did have some pretty big deals in Q1. We had Bristol Myers Squibb and Evotec. They signed one for neurodegenerative disease therapies for about $4 billion. We had AbbVie and Immunome joined together on oncology antibody targets for $2.8 billion. And we had MacroGenix and Synaffix expanded an antibody drug conjugate deal with another $2.2 billion. So those three joined with about 12 other deals in Q1 to become 15 mega deals. We call these mega deals those that are worth $1 billion or more. And those 15 mega deals are about 56% of the overall deal value in Q1.
Did those deals focus, was there a trend in the therapeutic area or modalities among those deals?
As we've seen in the past, you know, a good chunk of them are for cancer. 32% of these partnerships were focused on cancer, 17% for neurological disease. So they were, about half are those two therapeutic areas. As for modalities, small molecules represented 35%. Cell or gene therapies were 13%. Monoclonal antibodies were 10% of those deals.
Hey, I want to ask you about M&As. They continue to struggle. Why so much this quarter?
Well, M&As, they've not been doing well the last few years. Our numbers show there were 34 in the first quarter that closed, and they are valued at about $9 billion. Now, when we do this, we're only counting the ones that close. So compared to last year's first quarter, we did have more close this year, 34 versus 25, but the value of those M&As were significantly down, $9 billion versus $16 billion. In comparison to other years, M&As are struggling, but we did have three M&As in Q1 that were worth more than $1 billion. That was AstraZeneca acquiring Cinqor Pharma for $1.8 billion, Sumitomo acquiring Myovant for $1.7 billion, and Merck acquiring Imago Biosciences for $1.1 billion. So they may have been struggling the last few years because companies were able to raise money more easily, or maybe there's fewer M&As because of a disconnect. I've heard it said a disconnect between valuations, on valuations between buyers and sellers. But we do kind of think there may be a rebound that's happening. And that has to do with some big M&As that are pending. So announced in March was Pfizer's offer for Seagen for $43 billion. That's expected to close later this year or early in 2024. We also have Amgen's $27.8 billion offer to buy Horizon Therapeutics. That was announced last December. It's expected to close mid-year. And Merck is buying Prometheus for $10.8 billion. That was just announced a few days ago and could close as early as the third quarter this year. And also this week, I think you wrote the story, Lee, we had GSK offering to buy Bellus Health for $2 billion. So if all of those close this year, we'll be ahead of last year. And I will say those first three I mentioned, Pfizer, Seagen, Amgen, Horizon, Merck, Prometheus, if those close, they're going to be on BioWorld's top 20 list of acquisitions of biotech developers. So there are some big ones.
Yeah. So now that you've done this first quarter story, do you have some ideas, some of the trends that point toward the future?
You know, it's always hard to say when you talk about the future. It's, I guess, just listening to some others speak and reading and seeing what other analysts are saying. I hear quite a lot about how crowded things have become, how many scientists are out there trying to raise money. And, you know, ultimately what is supposed to happen is the best science should get through. They should get the funding, the partnerships, et cetera. But I do suspect these crowds will also result in some very good opportunities becoming invisible. So, you know, hopefully as we move toward the future, our industry will get better at messaging so that there's a better understanding of the industry and how it works, because there has been a lot of resistance that we've faced from, you know, Inflation Reduction Act, drug pricing, WTO waiver. Again, these things are making it harder to drive innovation forward.
Thanks, Karen. Some of those are concerns of Tim's too. So I want to turn to him. Tim Shannon from Kanin Partners. He's had a long career in healthcare, and he's a long-term investor with a big picture view that's based on years of experience. Tim, I want to ask you, is there anything that jumped out at you from that Q1 data, whether it was good or bad?
You know, I would say there's still a lot of uncertainty in the direction of, you know, the biotech market in general. I think that uncertainty is obviously greater with the smaller companies who are pre-revenue or just with their early revenues compared to the larger companies who have revenue streams. So I think both of them are facing uncertainties from a whole range of directions, you know, some of which Karen mentioned. So, and I think when there's uncertainty, again, people, you know, are generally more cautious and more considerate of what they're doing, whether it's M&A or partnerships or investing in new companies. So I still think a lot of uncertainty, which raises questions in minds and people in companies and investors, and keeps things at a slower pace than in times when there's more certainty, be it on the geopolitical level, the U.S. political level, the macroeconomic level, and again, you can throw a whole host of other things that are sort of creating this time of uncertainty. So I think, you know, until some of that plays out a little bit, my guess is we're going to bobble around at about this level.
Well, you described yourself when you and I talked about 2 weeks ago that as being extremely cautious, but you're in the fray. I want to know, what were your biggest concerns in putting together this latest fund?
Well, you know, again, I think, you know, Kanin's had good fortune to, you know, be in the business for over 35 years now. So, you know, we have, you know, excellent LP relationships and a track record. And again, I think what helped us is, you know, we have a track record through the ups and downs. So, you know, in times like this, when frankly, a lot of LPs are cautious, you know, I think because of our, you know, the history we have of navigating these waters, you know, we were able to raise money. As I think about the environment, you know, I think as we discussed, you know, I personally was a little bit on the sidelines, I would say, in 2021 and 22, just because I thought, you know, particularly 2021, there's just so much money flowing into the system and valuations were so high that it was, you know, hard for me to get my head around a realistic investment thesis in making an investment. But I think, you know, those issues have started to work their way out of the system, meaning valuation expectations as well as fundraising expectations, you know, are starting to resettle a different place, which I think makes investing more interesting again, you know, from a return profile perspective. Just recently, a company was announced. I did a Series A company called Air. We actually closed that last year. So, you know, that was something I was working on last year, and I have a couple more in the hopper that, you know, I've been working on for the past 6 months. So I do think from the private perspective, there again, there's been a recalibration of valuation that does make it a much more interesting time to invest again, with the belief that by the time those investments come to fruition in those operating companies, you know, the markets will have gotten to a better place, so that that value can be recognized in a market that's, you know, more receptive to value recognition than today's markets.
So a big picture on the markets. or the headwinds that we discussed a couple of weeks ago, politics and regulations, and especially for small molecule oncology. Can you give me an idea of what your biggest concerns are with that?
Yeah, there's a range of them that Karen mentioned, and I'll just mention two before I get into this. One, I think, is the patent issues that came up during COVID and continue to persist in terms of respecting patents worldwide. Certainly was a big one. The other one that I would just mention on the side on the M&A issue is, again, we have a very aggressive FTC intervening in what they believe is trying to protect consumers, via anti-competitive mergers. It's all in the eye of the beholder, but that is definitely on everyone's mind when they consider M&A. And it's M&A between big companies, but it's also M&A with big companies and small companies. So those are just two things inside. With small molecules in oncology, I think in oncology in general, there have been a number of issues. I mean, first of all, like I say, we've had an incredible 20 years in oncology drug development, which has resulted in a tremendous amount of investment going into that area. And part and parcel of that has been part of the reason we've seen a reduction in cancer morbidity and mortality in the world, and in particular in the U.S. So it's been an incredibly productive time, enabled by a couple things. And I'll give this backdrop first, and I'll go with my concerns. One is the underlying science. So, cancer was a huge beneficiary of the Human Genome Project and the advances in sequencing and making sequencing available cheaply and in real time. And as cancer's in part been dissected into a number of genetic diseases genes that mutate during life and cause cancer. And that's, really given us levers to develop very effective drugs that impact people's lives in great ways. And also, provide a lot of reward in terms of the investment and the revenue side of that. So that's been a big driver. The other big driver, though, has been two things that hasn't changed, that won't change, that will remain put. Two positive features that are now tipping the other way, I would say, has been the incredible regulatory support for oncology drug development, number one, and then the pricing support in the marketplace for pharmaceuticals in general, in particular oncology drugs, which really have come on the market in a big time in the last 20 years. Again, on the I'll start with the pricing side. So the biggest risk there is the Inflation Reduction Act, which targets small molecules and effectively limits your patent protection. That's just the only way to say it. So it takes your normal patent protection and takes it down to 9 years. When frankly, while there's this negotiation process, it's unclear how much of a negotiation that's going to be versus just the government setting the price. And while that just affects Medicare, it will affect the entire market, because once those prices are reset for a drug in Medicare, private insurers are not going to pay 30 or 40% more for that drug. So it will move the whole market. And moreover, it's not a onesie-twosie sort of thing, or whatever the first number of drugs is, 8 or 10 in the first year. If you pick a category leader, for instance, in lung cancer, and you reduce its price by 30%, everything in that category will have to be reduced comparably relative to that market leader. So it really has a profound impact of shortening the commercial life of small molecule cancer drugs. Now that's an issue in general for cancer. It's a bigger issue because in cancer drug development, the first approvals are in the most desperate patients. So those are people who've gone through all, have metastatic disease, have gone through all available therapies and get benefit from this new therapy and it goes on the market. Those aren't the most important markets, though. Cancer drug development over time progresses from those worst case patients to patients you can potentially cure. So patients who have their first metastatic disease and have an opportunity to cure are, an example of where you would go 4 or 5 years after that first approval. After those metastatic patients, you would go into patients who've had their tumors resected but have a high chance of recurring with metastatic tumors with your drug. So that's called adjuvant therapy or neoadjuvant therapy. And that might come on the market 4 or 5 years after that, because those are much longer studies, much larger investments, and there's a de-risking element by getting, showing you have activity in the worst patients. By doing that, you're more likely to have activity in the patients who have less disease. So cancer drug development goes through a time-oriented sequence where you go from smaller markets to larger markets over time. And that spreads out the investment horizon. It also, as I said, de-risks it, because if it doesn't work in the advanced populations, you're probably not going to take, you know, spend the money in those populations. But that takes decades to do. And now, theoretically, you have 9 years. So that really upends the, what has been the normal cancer drug development. And it, what it probably will do is compress the time frame in which you need to make all those investments and make them more risky again, because you won't be de-risking them by doing them sequentially. You know, and I worked here, I should work here, I worked there, I should work in the next one. So I think in long and short, that you have two things going on. One, on the pricing side, one, you're constraining the back end, so you're diminishing revenues. Two, you're increasing the cost and risk of development. And that's just a bad thing for investment, right? That's really the opposite of what you want to do. So that's on the pricing side. And then just briefly on the regulatory side, as you're all aware, there's been a huge pushback on accelerated approvals. So again, this era was heralded by drugs like Gleevec and Velcade that got approved in single-arm, uncontrolled studies based on response rate and duration of response. So these drugs' initial approvals were, you know, literally in 50 to 100 patients, where 25 to 50% of them showed a great response, uncontrolled, and they were approved. Those days are gone. So, there's been pushback on accelerated approval. And what accelerated approval has basically become now are large randomized controlled studies. And your acceleration is getting approved on progression-free survival, with overall survival still to come in the same study. So the pushback and modulations and accelerated approval have, resulted in a change from really small, efficient studies to get those first approvals to much larger, much longer, much more costly approvals to get the accelerated approval based on PFS. And frankly, OS, overall survival, is usually in the same study, and it just will take a couple of years later. So that was regulatory tailwinds that really propelled oncology to be so attractive from an investment. Also, if taken a negative turn. So I think about both the government pricing issues, which are negative, and then, FDA buckling down on accelerated approvals. Now, I would just say there are two sides to this, right? So I think everyone would like, less costly drugs, and I'll raise my hand there, I agree. So I think I understand the reasons behind trying to do this. And so for some parts of society, this might be the best way to do it. But I am fearful that these create negative headwinds in a field that has been revolutionary in the last 20 years. And I think you'll start seeing some investment tipping away from oncology and out into other areas. So I know that's a lot, but happy to take any follow-ups.
No, that's fine. I think that's great. I wanted to ask you about that while we were talking about costs and pricing. You had mentioned that the U.S. pricing subsidizes medicines for the rest of the world. It just seems like it's what comes with the territory, but I wonder, is there another way to do this?
Yeah, well, I don't know what. Again, I think it's true. So if you look at the profitability of drugs elsewhere in the world, if we didn't have the United States, there wouldn't be an industry, and there wouldn't be investment in the industry, and I think that's just a fact. Now, it's a very difficult issue to deal with. Obviously our government, cannot do anything to force other governments to price their drugs differently, right? That's nearly impossible. Companies tend to make them available. Again, because they feel some obligation to do so, countries where they can at least break even. I think there are more rational ways to reduce costs than what I would call blunt instruments, which are going to impact investment. So I'd like to find ways to reduce costs in ways that actually encourage investment. And I think that there are ways to conceive of that doing, but again, they're difficult to do. But at the end of the day, I think this is the way I look at it. The U.S. subsidizes a lot of things in the world. And the one I always think of is the defense of the free world, right? We are the world's military. And we invest in the military in the U.S. knowing that. We know that the world depends on us, and we are willing to step up because it's in our best interest as a company. And to me, that's the cost of leadership and leadership in the free world. I think there's the same cost in the leadership in science and medicine. There should be an expectation if we are going to be a leader that we are going to foot more of the bill. And as I would say, what's the alternative? Like, if we don't do that, who is going to do it? And I don't know the answer to that. I think it's likely to be no one, or it's going to be someone that actually we don't want being the leader in doing that. Again, I just don't think that's a world we want. So I think the expectation that prices in the U.S. should be the same as prices in the other world are just, you know, they're just not consistent with, you know, U.S. leadership in science and medicine.
Is there a big feeling that they should be that consistent? I wasn't aware of that.
Well, I think every time, you know, when you hear all the pushback on U.S. prices, the common example people will use is comparative pricing in other countries. So I see this in pieces all the time that write about the distortions in U.S. pricing. It always goes to, you know, how can it cost so much in the U.S. when it's 50% of that in Germany or 30% of that in Europe? So I think it is a frequent argument that people critical of U.S. pricing use. And I see it all the time. But I think, there are reasons for it.
Yeah. Well, Tim, thank you very much for sharing your expertise. Best of luck with the fund. We'll be watching it.
Thank you.
And Karen, also, thank you to you. I look forward to seeing the second quarter numbers.
Thanks, Lee.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad to have you. Lynn, it's all yours.
Thank you, everyone. So BioWorld does a lot of analysis related to the business development transactions that evolve the whole drug development market. But it's important to remind everyone that it's all related to the most innovative therapeutics in development. It's about improving the human condition, helping to cure diseases, improving quality of life, and extending our healthy lifespans. All of that requires financial backing and impacts the rise and fall of amazing scientific advances. As always, BioWorld will continue to keep you informed of all the most important scientific, clinical, and business updates. That's our show for today. If you need to track the development of drugs, turn to BioWorld.com. Follow us on Twitter, and you can reach out to us at newsdesk@BioWorld.com. And if you're enjoying the podcast, don't forget to subscribe. Thanks for joining us.
BioWorld, published by Clarivate, is a subscription-based news service that delivers actionable intelligence on the most innovative therapeutics and medical technologies in development.